Everybody, welcome again to our second webinar on the Redevelopment Academy Real Estate Series. We're so pleased to have you all here again. For those who are coming back and joined us on September 13th, thanks for coming back. For anybody new, hello. And we also are going to give you the information for how to catch up that first webinar from last month. So, we are really excited about today, and you are going to see we've just pulled up our second poll question, so thank you to everybody who's filling that out. We're going to be giving you one more poll before I turn it over to our speakers, so just watch out for that. So I just wanted to give a really brief introduction to our program here at EPA. We're the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization. Our office primarily provides grants for site assessment and cleanup of brownfields. And this really smaller part of our program, but a very exciting part of our program, is called Land Revitalization, where we get to focus on the reuse of properties, contaminated properties, and how to do that while achieving environmental, equitable, and economic benefits. And we've been working on this with communities for a long time, trying to promote reuse. And we actually have several pretty recent publications that you see up on your screen right now. You can access those in the URL box just to the right. We've got the Anatomy of Brownfields Redevelopment and the Community Actions that Drive Brownfields Redevelopment there. We will also make sure we include the links for the 2019 Brownfields Federal Programs Guide, which just got posted some point between the last webinar and this one, and our leveraging guide from a couple of years ago. So we want to make sure that you have access to those and you can use those as follow-up materials as you work with your communities. So we're putting these webinars on because we really want to share with you the redevelopment process for brownfields and specifically how developers perceive and deal with contaminated sites when planning redevelopment. And today we're going to be talking about the role of the market and what to do when there is no market or the market is quite weak. And then next month, on November 8th, we're going to be concluding the webinar part of this series with information on financing and funding concepts and how that factors into the financial bottom line for a redevelopment. And we're building this series on some work that we did here at EPA last year with our state and tribal partners. And so we took the information that we prepared last year and the feedback that we got from state and tribal partners and the feedback that we've gotten from communities over the year, and that's how we're putting the information together for this webinar series. We're also going to have a workshop at the National Brownfields Training Conference, which is in Los Angeles on December 10th. So I certainly hope that you can join us for that. And here is some information about the conference. The workshop itself is the day before the conference starts, as I said, on December 10th. We're going to be using that workshop time to apply all the concepts that you're learning about through these webinars and wade through projects where you get to be the developer who gets to pitch project ideas to a site owner and local government. We're going to be breaking for questions at two points through the webinar today. So as Jean said, please be sending in your questions through the Q&A box, and I'll be moderating those and getting answers to those as we go through the presentation. Okay, that's enough from me. Right now I'm going to turn it over to our instructor team for today. We have Elaine Richardson and Abby Emerson from Vita Nova. And before they speak, Michael Taylor, who's the president of Vita Nova, is going to say a few words to kind of tie all these concepts together. And just wanted to let everyone here know that our office has gotten to work with Vita Nova for many years. They're redevelopment consultants. The team's done a lot of land revitalization projects across the country over the years, dealing with brownfield sites all the time. Their work with EPA has helped communities identify some real feasible reuse opportunities and work with them to move sites into redevelopment. So this team brings a lot of expertise to the topic, and that's why we have them here to share this information with you today. So I'm going to turn it over to Mike. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Amy. Really appreciate that. I just wanted to set the stage a little bit since Abby and I did the first webinar on the redevelopment process and show how this sort of ties together and why we have Elaine and Abby running this webinar. If you'll go to the next slide. For those that, we talked about it a lot last time, but for those that weren't on the last webinar, the market, as it's talked about in the professional community, is usually first-tier market. New York, Chicago, San Francisco, those kind of things. And it's sort of, the profession, once it gets out into rural communities or a lot of industrial communities where there are brownfield sites, they don't have as much to say. There aren't big real estate brokers tracking data. There may not be a lot of data. So if you go to Chicago today, you can get reports about every major market from all the real estate brokers for free because there's so much going on. But you go over to Gary, Indiana, or Toledo, Ohio, or even Detroit, and you won't find as much. And so one of the things that we've tried to do is to talk about all tiers of communities. Last time we talked about tier 1, 2, 3, and 4 and how it's relevant. The market issues are relevant in all of those communities. And what's great about Elaine and Abby is they've been around the brownfields world for a long time. They've been in these communities. They know where you have to start to be able to identify the market. And so I think you're going to hear a lot of good things that are relevant wherever you are. If you're in Chicago, great. But if you're down in South Texas somewhere, you're going to hear a lot of things that are important to you as well. Next slide. This is going to be broken up as Amy said, but we're going to go through all the key components of looking at the market in this webinar. And so I'm very excited to turn it over to Abby and hope that you all get as much out of it as I have working with these folks over the last 15, 20 years. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. Before we get going, I'm going to do something similar to the way we set up our last webinar, and that is before we get going in the nitty-gritty of talking about the redevelopment analysis process, I just want to take a moment and set the stage by discussing some terminology and then going over the importance of market-based redevelopment in the real estate world. So as we go through the presentation today, we will be using some real estate terms or jargon. And a number of these will probably be familiar, but I want to highlight a few of them and how they relate specifically to real estate development. The first one is market analysis. And I know you might be saying, hey, isn't that why we're here on this webinar this morning? And it is. It's obviously our main topic today. But again, before we go into specifics, I want to clarify what it means when we say market analysis. And market analysis means different things at different times in the development process. It can mean a really quick desktop review of demographics done by a developer when he or she is sitting at their desks and evaluating multiple potential sites, or it could be a more comprehensive and detailed analysis of a specific redevelopment type, such as office uses or retail uses. In the more comprehensive analysis, more specific data is needed to accurately estimate the market size and conditions. And an example of this type of data are psychographics, which is our next term. And we'll again touch on psychographics a little bit later in the presentation. But briefly, psychographics are a method of describing consumers based on their psychological attributes. This includes buying habits, hobbies, values, things like that. And this type of data is particularly useful when evaluating retail and recreational uses. And finally, our last term I wanted to cover is shovel-ready. You might be familiar with this term. And these are projects where the analysis, environmental investigations, approvals, and entitlements have all been completed and permits have already been issued, or at the very least, they can be obtained within 90 days. So moving on to the importance of market-based redevelopment. This may be obvious to some of you, but I want to highlight why we're going into detail about the analysis portion of the redevelopment process and why grounding redevelopment in a market-based approach is crucial to a project's success. Knowing and analyzing the market for a brownfield site ensures that all the involved parties understand the realistic land use options for the site. And by doing the upfront analysis, the redevelopment has a much greater likelihood of obtaining funding in the short term, as well as staying financially successful in the long term. And this financial success can potentially provide funding for ongoing maintenance, as well as any environmental or institutional controls that may be necessary, and really ensures that the site is protected going forward in the long term. So if you joined us for our first webinar in September, this graphic will be familiar. In that first webinar, we went through all three development phases, which every project goes through, assuming that it reaches completion. But today, we're going to focus on the analysis section of the pre-development phase in much greater detail. The analysis portion of a redevelopment project, if done correctly, can set up a project for long-term success and sustainability. Grounding a redevelopment plan in market-based research can make the difference between a project that thrives and one that is destined to fail and potentially restarting the brownfield cycle all over again. So I have just set the stage, and I'm going to pass it over to Elaine to talk a little bit about the real estate market.
Thank you, Abby. So we're going to talk, for starters, as to where does development come from? Because as Abby said, to be sustainable, a development must be market-based. So it's helpful to understand where developments come from and what drives market demand. First, a majority of all real estate development is created through local investments. This is especially true in Tier 2 small cities, Tier 3 suburban markets, as well as Tier 4 rural markets. Local services and small businesses are the backbone of our economy, and they drive most of real estate developments. Small businesses, medical offices, and service industry expansions are the most common developments in these tiered markets, and while they may not be large, they are sustainable. Larger developments, such as corporate investments, typically follow significant business moves, such as mergers and acquisitions. These large corporate investments typically target Tier 1 cities. We've seen this recently in the pharmaceutical and technology industries. Infrastructure-driven developments, such as energy and technology, are often driven by regulatory opportunities and technology examples. For example, the construction of data centers for storage of cloud-based data has been the focus of development over the last 5 to 8 years and continues to be so. These centers are often located in low-cost power regions close to fiber optic routes, so they're not necessarily driven by the market itself as much as it is driven by infrastructure. Foreign investment and development by foreign-owned companies follow international economic and trade policy. For instance, the U.S. EB-5 visa program, for instance, attracts foreign money to new developments. The EB-5 program offers foreigners green cards or permanent residence in exchange for investing $500,000 in certain U.S. businesses that create at least 10 jobs per investor. So it's driving what's going on in the foreign investment market. Market demand in the various real estate sectors is driven by more than just economic growth. So housing demand is influenced by the number of households in a community, the age of a population, and other demographics. These influences can change over time regardless of economic growth. For instance, the rental apartment market has been in a growth mode for the past 5 years. That's being driven by two demographic sectors. First, the 20 to 30-year-old market is choosing rental over ownership. This is a result of the heavy college debt, couples choosing to marry at a later age, and the propensity for this age group to change jobs every two to three years, so they don't want to be tied down by home ownership. But the second group are seniors. Seniors are also choosing to rent rather than downsize to a new home. Renting provides greater flexibility, allows seniors to move around, and seniors don't have to worry about selling their house if they need to go into a healthcare facility. And this was a specific problem that occurred in the 2008 real estate downturn when a number of seniors who needed to downsize could not sell their home at the price they expected. And so it's changed their habits. The office and warehouse developments are driven more about access to labor and the proximity to transportation and economic centers. Like housing, retail is driven by demographics, household income, and disposable income, meaning the amount of money available to spend after basic needs of food and shelter are met, are key demographic factors that drive retail development. If you participated in the first webinar, we discussed that there were different types of developers that specialize in different types of real estate development. A developer who specializes in single-family residential development typically won't be interested in a commercial property. And a warehouse distribution developer may not consider a property that has mixed use potential. So it's helpful to understand the development potential of a property so that you can reach out and engage the appropriate type of developers for the property that you're interested in. So how do you determine real estate development? Well, you need to understand the characteristics of your site, both positive and negative, and match those characteristics with the proper land uses and developers. You need to be able to answer some of the questions that you see here, such as what are the characteristics that make your site attractive? Are there constraints on development? Is there a stigma with the site? And who are the users that might be interested? Over the next several slides, we'll review three types of analyses that are used to help you determine the redevelopment potential. They include an opportunities and constraints analysis, a market analysis, and a feasibility analysis. An opportunities and constraints analysis is something a property owner or a community can do to identify the positives and negatives associated with a site. This is a broad review of the property using publicly available data and a comprehensive site inspection to identify property assets. This is also something that private developers and site selection professionals do from their desktop to evaluate available properties in relationship to their interest and needs. An opportunities and constraints analysis will include looking at site characteristics and needs, looking at its location, available infrastructure, and if there's any limitations on infrastructure. It will look at area economy and demographics. We just talked a little bit about why demographics are important. It will focus on the physical and environmental conditions of a property, not just whether or not it's contaminated, but are there wetlands, floodplain, or other ecological features that may constrain development. It will focus on regulations, not just local regulations, but federal and state regulations, and the reputation the area has for cooperation by identifying if there's any challenges related to the regulatory process, you may be able to address some of those concerns and issues in order to attract additional development. And finally, real estate market conditions. Market demand and pricing are critically important data points in the opportunities and constraints analysis. A market analysis is a more in-depth look at the local and regional real estate market to understand trends, activities, and demand. The information gathered in the opportunities and constraints analysis will help provide factual data about the property to use in refining the market analysis. Property owners and communities can work with local real estate professionals to evaluate the market potential for a property. So Mike mentioned that large cities have a lot of market data that's free, but even in local, smaller communities and even rural areas, it's your local real estate agents that can help you gather the information you need to put together a market analysis. Interested developers will conduct their own market analysis to evaluate the economic feasibility of their development concepts within the local and regional market. A development concept that is profitable within one geographic region may not be profitable in another region based upon rental rates, tax structures, and land prices. Assuming the property meets the physical criteria a developer is looking for and the real estate market is attractive, a developer will further invest in the planning process and perform a feasibility analysis. This is an in-depth evaluation of the property to determine the likelihood of success from an engineering, financial, regulatory, and permitting perspective. The feasibility analysis is conducted further into the pre-development stage after a letter of intent or purchase and sale agreement are in place. I'm going to talk a little bit more specifically about the opportunities and constraints analysis, which will help you identify redevelopment potential. So what do developers actually look for in a property? Most of you have probably heard the phrase location, 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 but that's not entirely accurate. It's actually about access, location, and visibility. I'm going to talk about each of these three attributes in the context of a recent Brownfields redevelopment project that attracted Bass Pro Shops. Access means different things to different developers. It includes local roads and intersections, highways and exit ramps, passenger and freight rail, and even water access for certain types of developments. Developers will analyze a site's proximity to transportation routes, as well as the quality, condition, and most important, the capacity for these roads and rails to handle more traffic. And developers will look at the feasibility of improving some of these access points. They'll ask the questions, can roads be widened without buying up more properties? Will the Department of Transportation allow a new exit ramp? These are the questions the developers and their planning teams will explore. In the case of the Bass Pro Shops here, access to the property is twofold. Access is from the waterfront that you can see right here along the property line, and from the highway. And both of these were specifically key. The shop offers classes on kayaking and other water-based sports. And the shop expected to draw from a one-hour radius, so highway access was absolutely critical. Location is much more than a spot on a map. Developers look at the neighborhood setting, adjacent land uses, and sensitive receptors. And they look at the local and regional people, culture, and climate. They're taking the temperature of the community to determine if this location fits with their business plan. For Bass Pro Shops, this location was ideal as it was centrally located in the middle of a three-state metropolitan area. The site was a redevelopment priority for both the local city and the state, and there were incentives available to help build any necessary infrastructure. Visibility is a factor that many developers consider in selecting a site. For retail and commercial uses, good visibility is important. For other uses, such as power generation and mission-critical data centers, seclusion is more attractive. Again, looking at the Bass Pro Shops, as you can see from this aerial, the site was visible from the highway overpass, where 300,000 cars traveled each day. In addition, the property was also visible from a passenger commuter rail line that flowed underneath the highway and a water ferry that traveled in the harbor. So let's take a minute to talk about how companies select sites. Brand name, retail, and commercial companies have specific criteria for their locations. For instance, a chain fitness center prefers to be located in a shopping center. They require a population of 25,000 people or more within a 5-mile radius, and they're looking for a population with a large percentage of females between the age of 20 and 65. While these are just guidelines, the point here is to understand that you can't attract all types of developments to your community. You need to understand the assets that your community and your property has to offer and target the appropriate type of developer and development. Corporate site selection, such as the one that Amazon just went through for their HQ2 project, have very specific criteria. Time and budgets drive the selection process. Corporations will evaluate the regulatory climate, looking at unions, right-to-know laws, worker compensation laws, special licensing requirements, and the environmental and OSHA environment. They're looking to understand how regulations and the regulatory climate will drive their operations. They will look at the tax structure, property taxes, employment taxes, and corporate income taxes. They will review the operating environment. Are there threats of natural disasters that they have to manage? What's the public transportation structure? Are construction costs higher than normal, or are they in line with what industry averages are? And what are the impacts of climate change to the region? They will further look at access to markets, meaning airports, ports, and proximity not only to major markets, but directly to their consumers. And finally, they're going to look at workforce needs, training and education, and the quantity of available workers. That gives you a little bit of an idea of what developers look for when they look at a property. Now we're going to talk specifically about the market analysis process. All market analyses evaluate the same general data. Some are more detailed than others. Real estate follows a cycle of four stages: peak, downturn, trough, followed by recovery. Most markets across the country right now are at peak. But developers have different preferences and perspectives on the real estate cycle. When the market is hot, for instance, contaminated sites are more attractive because they are typically less expensive than other sites and financing is easier to come by. But during these peak markets, developers are very busy and they don't always have time to focus on the details and complexities of contaminated sites. We have found that during the downturn phase, developers have more time to spend understanding the complexities of contaminated sites. But they struggle with the fact that money can be harder to come by, and interest rates are often more expensive during that phase. A market analysis will look at three general types of data: census-related data, such as demographics, economic patterns, and employment statistics; property and leasing trends, including real estate sales, land prices, rental rates, occupancy and vacancy rates, as well as absorption rates, which indicate how quickly vacancies are actually being filled. In addition, some market analyses consider submarket data. For example, retail developers will analyze retail leakage studies, which tracks where consumers buy their different types of goods and how much of a community's spending is done outside of the town versus locally. And this can help identify if there are gaps in the local market that could be filled by new retail development. I'm going to spend a few minutes explaining how and why developers focus on some of these data points. Distribution and logistics centers are one of the hottest real estate markets today. From Amazon's huge warehouses to the last mile warehouses storing inventory for daily deliveries to retail stores, these facilities are based on two main factors. First is geographic location relative to customers, whether their customers be actual retail stores or direct consumers. And the second factor that drives site selection is labor demographics. These large warehouses can employ 1,500 to 3,000 workers. These are minimum wage or lower wage jobs, and the workers have fairly high turnover, so the labor pool needs to be extremely large. In addition, employees generally are high school graduates of lower income that need access to public transportation. So all of those characteristics go into selecting this. A workforce made up of a large percentage of postgraduate educated workers is not necessarily going to be attractive when a developer is looking to put a large distribution warehouse in place. Warehouse developers are today, as we speak, identifying potential regions and preferred sites for their warehouses strictly from their desktop using publicly available real estate data and census demographics. Abby mentioned the term psychographics. For retail, housing, and recreational concepts, developers look very closely at psychographics. These are focused subsections of typical demographic data that analyze populations based upon their income, spending and leisure habits and personal preferences. This psychographic data helps end users build a real estate product targeted to a very specific subgroup of the market. Each time we use the courtesy discount card at our grocery store or pharmacy or sporting goods store or buy something through Amazon Prime, our preferences and habits are being documented and tracked. And all of that information is being used by developers to locate new real estate developments. So looking at these, can you figure out which demographic, psychographic group you belong to? We'll come back and ask you that when we get into our question section, how many people have looked at this in a little more detail. So we've talked about two of the three types of data that make up a market analysis. The third data point, and the most obvious, is real estate supply and demand. But this is more than just understanding what properties are currently on the market. Developers will look at the existing buildings and evaluate their age, condition, and functionality. Older buildings with hazardous building materials such as asbestos and lead paint may be more expensive to renovate and to bring up to current code, so building new may be more of a demand. Construction and operating costs can vary substantially from region to region depending on labor costs, labor laws, transportation, and access to material. And vacancy rates include more than just the empty space. Developers will also look at construction permits to anticipate how quickly demand will be met and what is actually in the real estate pipeline. So we started out this webinar discussing three types of analysis that are used to determine lead development potential. We talked a little bit about opportunities and constraints analysis. I reviewed the components of the market analysis. The third type of study is the feasibility analysis, which I said earlier is typically done once a letter of intent or purchase and sale agreement is in place. But before entering into those agreements, a developer needs to determine if the project is financially feasible. The market analysis will gather data regarding land costs, lease rates, and typical operating costs so that developers can run a simple financial model to determine if the project is feasible. At this stage in pre-development, developers will use the data gathered to determine the overall cost of the development and identify a required lease or sale rate for the development to be profitable. Those lease rates are then compared to current rates in the market to determine if the project is feasible. We typically refer to that as a back-of-the-envelope calculation, and we're using pretty basic data to determine if the project is feasible at this stage. How these models or pro formas are structured and what goes into them and how one or two variables can change the outcome of those models will actually be the focus of our next webinar in November, where we talk more about the financial modeling aspect. In a few minutes, Abby's going to talk about some of the things that communities can do to attract development. But first, we want to take a few questions. And Amy, I think you're going to lead us in that section.
Yep, I sure am. Thanks, Elaine. Thanks, Abby. We have a few questions that came in. And so the first one I want to ask is, Elaine, you mentioned site selector a couple of times. Can you clarify what is a site selector? What's their job? How does it work?
Absolutely. So a site selector is a real estate professional. Sometimes that is their sole practitioner, and sometimes they are also real estate brokers, but they are actually hired by a company or a developer to find a site that fits very specific criteria It could be within a region or it could be across the country. In many cases, it could be an organization that's looking for multiple locations, such as a warehouse distribution that needs to put 8 distribution centers across the country, would hire a site selection professional to find potential regions that might fit the criteria where they could fit these 8 locations.
Thank you. So it sounds like a little bit like they're a scout, like scouting the market.
That's a great term.
What did you say?
That's a great term.
Yeah, I mean, would you ever say that they get they really just work for the organizations that hire them, or are they out there in front of property owners at these potential locations trying to, you know, start deal making? Or
so one of the things to realize about how site selection works is that about 80% of the decision making process is completed from a desktop between the client that's looking for a site and the site selection professional based on publicly available data. And that's something that Abby's going to talk about in a few minutes about how you can improve your chances of being noticed. Because so much of the decision, 80%, is being made before anyone even knows a company is looking for a site. What Amazon just did with their HQ2, where they went out publicly and basically announced to the country that they were looking for a location for a second headquarters, is extremely unusual. What usually happens is a site selection professional is looking for criteria, just as I explained, based on demographics, transportation, access, location, may or maybe not visibility, workforce, tax structure, all of those things. And they will select a region that may have 10 or 12 sites. And it's once they get down to a regional level that they would then get involved with the local community or a local real estate agent or a property owner in the community to talk specifics about a deal. But that's in the final 10 to 20% of the process.
Excellent. Thanks for talking about that. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, next question. I'm not sure at what point you mentioned it, Elaine, but you talked briefly about sensitive receptor. You used that term. Can you just give some examples of what you consider to be a sensitive receptor?
Sure. So I was talking to the type of environmental and ecological features that may be an opportunity or a challenge. So I mentioned wetlands and floodplains. We're all pretty familiar with that. But you also may have properties that are in areas with sensitive habitats, that maybe there's endangered species on or near the site. There may be old growth forests, that there may be challenges with taking down some of the forest. There may be restrictions on if you clear any woodland, you have to replenish that at another location. So when I talk about sensitive receptors, it's various ecological features that could fall into that category.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, let's see, a couple more questions that we got. So we talked about, you walked us through the 3 types of analyses for redevelopment potential: the opportunities and constraints analysis, the market analysis, and the feasibility analysis. Can you just refresh for us kind of at what point in the property acquisition process you would do each one? We know it's you know, opportunities and constraints first, market second, feasibility analysis third, but you know, kind of where, at what point when you're looking to acquire property do you do each of those?
Sure. So an opportunities and constraints analysis is a very useful tool for both buyers and sellers. It's a good way for a seller, when they have a property they want to disposition, or a community that has a brownfield that they'd like to have redeveloped, to do that upfront, immediately, early in the process. Because what it does is it identifies what the assets are that you want to promote, and it also identifies the constraints. And finally, it identifies information gaps, and it tells you what information you're going to need to gather before a deal can be made. You can still be talking to developers about the property while you're gathering that information, but it's really helpful to do that early on, and developers will do that early on because it doesn't take a lot of investment to do that. As I said, it's done from desktop available information as well as a site walkthrough. So it's not, you're not investing a significant amount of money with certain expertise in order to do that work, and yet you can identify early on what the information is. A more in-depth market analysis is typically done by a developer when they think that the property fits all of the characteristics, the general characteristics that they have in terms of access, location, visibility, size, topography, the physical characteristics of the property. But now they need to know, is the market right? And so they'll do that after they're familiar with the property. They'll do the market analysis. And the feasibility analysis, as I said, that's a more in-depth engineering, financial, legal analysis that's done once you have entered into either a letter of intent or a purchase and sale agreement. That's when the developer will spend that kind of money, because that's when they're hiring engineers and attorneys and other specialty experts that they're going to spend significant dollars on.
Thank you very much. Okay, a couple more questions, and then we'll move back to Abby. Okay, so one question that came in is just trying to ask, like, if you were to say, you know, you told us that it's not just location, 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 but would you say there's a single most important factor to determine which city to invest in? You know, out of all the things that you shared with us, what really rises to the top? Anything? Or do you need all of the components that we talked about?
It really depends on the development. And so let's back up a minute and remember that most development is local. And so from a local standpoint, if it's a local business, a service sector, or a housing developer that is expanding locally, then they already know the location. That's their business area. It becomes more about access and if they need visibility, but all of the components as to getting to the site and how much do they have to spend on infrastructure. So for a majority of developments, the locale is decided. For the big developments or large retail investments or major housing investments where they're coming in to do a large multifamily apartment complex or gated community or something along those lines, that's where all three really matter, because they're comparing one region or one city or one town against another, and it becomes a comparison, and the one that has all three or the best of the three will rise to the top. As I said, in retail, visibility really matters. And in some other commercial uses that we talked about, such as fitness centers and recreational centers, all of that matters. For office buildings, it's about access. It's about access to transportation, whether it's public or roadways for car transportation. It's being able to get workers to the office and clients as well. Same thing with other commercial sectors. They're not necessarily as driven on visibility, but it's access. And then it all comes down to the demographics meeting the actual market of the development that's being considered.
Great. Thank you. Okay, last question. So there's all this market data, and it's giving us all this great information. But now there's a lot of areas across the country that have historically been disinvestment areas, but presumably because of the Opportunity Zones program and some other things, they are seeing renewed interest. And that's, you know, very different than what their market data would reflect. So I'm just wondering, like, how does the market component piece of this deal with some of those areas now that are, you know, people are looking at for investment? Probably sure. A tough question, but what can you tell us about, you know, how to reconcile market data with areas that have been historically disinvested in?
So in situations like that, you're not going to have, first off, you're not going to have a lot of information about lease rates and sale rates and whatnot, because there hasn't been a lot of activity in those markets. And so it's hard to have those data points. And secondly, you may not have properties that are ideal properties for someone to come in and do that, to do a development based upon the pure characteristics of the property. So you have to look at the whole picture, and that's where really looking at what the available workforce, the available community benefits are, and what is the regulatory climate, local, regional, and state. And when I say regulatory climate, you know, an awful lot of money is spent by developers in obtaining approvals, meaning all types of entitlements, whether it's planning and zoning approvals, building permits, air permits, whatever it is for their development. And so that's one thing that is more in the control of the communities, to try and streamline those things to make their communities more attractive. And so when developers go into some of those communities that have not historically had investments, they look at the whole package. They don't look at a singular data point to say this is the ideal location. And so if a community can try and improve portions of the package that they can control, that helps offset or fill in the gaps where there either isn't data or the data isn't very positive.
Thank you so much, Elaine. Really helpful and a great segue, because now we're going to move on to Abby. She's going to start explaining what communities can do to help reposition properties and attract development. So over to you, Abby.
Great. Thanks, Amy. So thanks for those great questions, too. So Elaine just went through all of these various analyses that developers use to evaluate potential projects. And while it is crucial that communities know and understand this process, there are two key things that I want to highlight that communities can do to smooth the path forward for their brownfield sites and for development, successful redevelopment on them. The first key to attracting development is to toot your own horn, promote your community. For example, specific types of uses, warehousing, residential, retail, require locations with particular demographics and labor force characteristics. And for the most part, developers can get this type of data easily elsewhere while sitting at their desktop. So communities should really focus their efforts on gathering and promoting information that's not easily accessible. So highlight what companies are located in your region, not just the name of the company, but what type of operations they have there in your community. If Staples is a major employer, is it a store, is it a distribution center, or a call center? This really matters for the type of development that will be attracted to your specific community. Do you have any economic clusters that developers can target? And this needs to be detailed. If your community's economic development strategy talks about biomedical clusters, does that mean research operations, pharmaceutical offices, or manufacturing facilities for medical devices? Be very specific. developers are looking at many sites at the same time. And site elimination, as Elaine said before, is often done before you even have a chance to explain yourself or you even know it's happening. So your information has to be clear and very easy to find. Has your community recently made investments in infrastructure? Make sure all of that information is out there in the public domain, in newspapers, on a community website. Your new highway connection or sidewalk extension project, as amazing as it might be, it won't matter if no one, or at least no developers, know about it. Also, many communities, regions, and states have databases of available properties. These lists are fantastic marketing opportunities, and they usually have little to no cost associated with them. And developers and site selectors definitely look at them because they can quickly get a picture of what's available in an area. The second thing that communities can do to attract development is to minimize the impediments for development. So what does this mean for a community? It means that information has already been collected and organized on the brownfield sites, and it can be easily accessed and shared with interested developers as they come up. Have a list of those shovel-ready projects. If a phase one has been completed on a property, have that available. Also, build partnerships with regulatory agencies at the regional, state, local levels. If everyone is on the same page from the start and shares the goal of redevelopment, it will be easier to work together. Streamline the entitlement process so that the pathway is clear. Have a key contact person or people who can shepherd the project through from start to finish, making the process as bump-free and as efficient as possible. Remember, one of those key takeaways from our last webinar, time kills all deals. The more information that's at your fingertips and the developer's fingertips, the better. And actually, many communities have started creating websites for their available brownfield properties with all of the relevant public information for each site easily and quickly accessible to potential developers. And while not all the information can be shared on a public website, include as much as you possibly can. And don't worry about these types of websites being duplicative with a regional or state database. As long as the information is correct and consistent across these different websites, the more exposure, the better. Also, one thing to keep in mind is that your community really only has control over city or county-owned properties, but many of the key sites that developers may be interested in are going to be privately owned. So make an effort to be in communication with those private landowners. Build relationships with them so that everyone is telling the same story and providing the same information. If possible, put those privately owned sites on the available properties list as well. Developers will be much more inclined to work in your community if the public and private sector are working together in their redevelopment efforts. So building on that previous slide, redevelopment or development really of any kind can spur interest and demand in your community. New hospitals, business parks, sports stadiums, and even improved highway access can draw developers into your community and catalyze redevelopment. Again, toot your own horn. Get the message out about the recent investments or those new developments. And reach out beyond just your community and make sure that you're reaching a larger audience, because you really never know where interest will come from. So as an example, there was a project that we worked on in the San Francisco Bay Area that had sat for years without any interest. But the state and county decided to make an investment in highway infrastructure, which cut travel times to the specific site. And they also promoted this investment they made in the new highway. Suddenly, there were multiple offers for the site, and it finally sold. So the outside infrastructure investment and the market's knowledge of the improvements led to the sale of a previously underutilized site. You need to capitalize on these opportunities, these types of opportunities, and be ready for them and have your sites ready for them. Developers are always looking for places to invest or do developments, and by promoting your community and its new projects, you're going to stay on that list. So I've been sort of talking around this in the past few slides, but I really want to call it out on this one. Advertising and marketing and promotion are not bad words. It is not only okay, but imperative that communities spread the word about their available properties and the assets they offer, whether that is a biomedical cluster, a highly educated workforce, or a high-achieving school district. Developers are looking at many, many sites at a cursory level. Your community or site needs to stand out in order to get a second glance. Just a slight caveat, though, please remember that EPA funds are not eligible to use on marketing and advertising, but that doesn't mean that they aren't worthwhile investments. As we've mentioned before, there are a number of ways to get the word out about your community. Local, state, regional websites and property databases are easy ways. But let me emphasize again how useful it is to have a clearinghouse for your community's brownfield-related property information. Again, this includes not only the city-owned and controlled properties, but information on privately owned brownfields as well. Work with your local realtors to get to know which properties are available and who might be looking to dispose of their sites. Make it as easy as possible for developers to see what's available, the condition, as well as any key facts you want to highlight about your community. So we've touched on promoting your community in the past few slides, but I want to narrow down for a moment and discuss attracting large organizations or corporations. And by this, I mean the Amazons and the Boeings of the world. These corporations are not going to look at a specific town or site. They are going to first focus on a region. And as we saw with Amazon's HQ2, these regions can cross not only city boundaries, but also states. Amazon may have chosen Arlington, Virginia, but you better believe that they looked at the labor pool and assets of the surrounding areas of Maryland and DC. And also just to note that occasionally regions can cross country boundaries when on the borders, like El Paso or Niagara Falls, and just something to keep in mind if you're located on a border. Because these corporations are looking holistically at a region, the cities and communities within the region need to adopt a similar strategy. Too often, cities, counties, and states maintain information in separate systems and formats, making it really difficult for a corporation or site selection consultants to identify the benefits of a particular region as a whole. Or the communities refuse to cooperate, looking at the other cities as competition. In places like the DC metro area, Cincinnati tri-state area, Hartford, Connecticut, Springfield, Mass., where multiple sites may be available across the state lines, the cities need to work together and highlight the diversity of the sites and regional assets to attract interest from developers. Competition among sites really only happens at the very last step, and a city really has to make the first cut to be in the game and compete at all. By cooperating, you have a much wider net to cast and can attract more interest in your shared assets than just a single city or a site. In the past few slides, we've discussed what communities can do to attract large and small-scale development and redevelopment projects, but let's take a moment to talk about the role of community input in these market-based redevelopment projects. Well, the community planning process is a useful step in redevelopment, particularly in the case of brownfields. It must be grounded in market reality. Elaine has a great saying on this topic that I'm going to steal here. If you build it, they will come, if it's market-based. But just because you want it doesn't mean a developer will come. So the community planning process must be based on facts. The market will decide what a project can be. But having a community planning process can help build confidence in the project, the developer, and the intended reuse or reuses. This process is often dependent on site ownership. So those sites that are owned and controlled by a community, city, county sites, those can undergo a formal community planning process. Privately owned properties may only engage the community in less formal ways and through the entitlement approval process, things like the planning and zoning hearings or city council meetings. And as part of this planning process, in either way it's conducted, formal or informal, community and stakeholder feedback is an important part. However, it's crucial when facilitating and attracting development that community leaders set proper expectations regarding redevelopment, both with the potential developers and with community members. Establish an easy-to-understand process that can truly be implemented and that everyone will stick to. and make sure that the community has a realistic expectations regarding redevelopment. As Elaine showed in her table before, if you know that a site doesn't have the traffic count to warrant a grocery store, don't set the expectation that a grocery store is a possibility. Developers are attracted to communities that are open to ideas and willing to listen, and less attracted to communities that have predetermined expectations for a property's reuse. And let me just call your attention to the website that's listed in the box on the screen. We shared these fact sheets in the previous webinar, but I wanted to highlight them here in case there's somebody in the audience that didn't attend our last webinar. These fact sheets go through a great deal of detailed information on the Brownfields redevelopment process and the community's role in the process, and are going to be a great resource for you going forward after this webinar is over. And finally, I'd like to end with another way communities are involved in the redevelopment process, and that is through stimulus packages. Regions and states frequently offer stimulus packages to encourage economic development, and the general public are often skeptical of their value. But in reality, particularly in third and fourth tier markets that we are looking at with Brownfields, stimulus packages of varying types do attract developers. Public funding and stimulus packages that support infrastructure investments can make the difference between a project that is financially feasible and one that's upside down. It's often the case that public utilities, like sewer, water, roads, can't support the additional use that will come from a new redevelopment project without expansion or upgrading of the utilities. Developers can typically handle infrastructure on the property itself, but not necessarily bringing utilities to the site or upgrading utilities off-site. So packages that, for example, upgrade a wastewater treatment plant or expand road connections can have a huge impact on the success of a project. Packages can also be used to improve resiliency from the standpoint of power, fiber, providing economic benefits not just to this specific project, but to the greater community, potentially helping spur additional economic development. Other types of stimulus programs help developers with property tax abatements and more typical economic development uses, such as workforce development, training, things like that. And this is particularly true in places where developers are comparing one region to another, and one of the regions can offer a more well-trained workforce. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Elaine, who's going to walk through a case study that used all three types of analyses that we touched on earlier, and also used marketing and promotion to effectively sell the property. Elaine.
Thank you, Abby. We talked quite a bit now about how developers evaluate reuse potential, and now I'd like to walk you through a recent redevelopment project in the Wilmington, Delaware, Greater Philadelphia region, and demonstrate how some of the concepts we've discussed played out in an actual redevelopment deal. This property was a large manufacturing site with over 100 years of industrial use. The property owner was a large employer in the community, and their plans were to shut down operations. And although they were shutting down operations, they were committed to looking for a buyer that would reuse the property in a manner that would benefit the community. While this was a private sector process, the steps and tools that were used to facilitate redevelopment are good examples of some of the actions that you can take in your own communities. As we discussed, in evaluating a property, a real estate developer looks at a broad range of site features to identify the potential benefits and flaws associated with implementing their redevelopment concept. Real estate presents numerous risks beyond environmental, and a developer's ability to make a profit is often dictated by the opportunities and constraints associated with the property itself. The owner of this property recognized that with over 100 acres of land, numerous buildings, and industrial features, developers could easily overlook the opportunities with this site. So the first thing the property owner did was an opportunities and constraints analysis, which I will walk through with you and explain. The opportunities and constraints analysis included an inventory and evaluation of the property's physical setting. As you can see here, the property is located on the Delaware River. There's a substantial amount of waterfront along the river. Some wharfs that exist on the property hadn't been used in a while, but were still located there. In addition, the property was located immediately adjacent to a major highway with actually an exit ramp right for this property, because this, as I said, was a major employer who was directly serving the property. Furthermore, looking at the location, the residential community closest to the property was on the other side of the highway. So there was a good buffer between the industrial use we have on the site and the residential use on the other side of the highway. So properties that have been in use for decades often have legal easements encumbering the property. In this case, and they're a little bit tough to see, but in this case, there's easements for water, sewer, gas, and power that exist on the property. Now, such easements do not necessarily mean the site can't be used, but it may require legal efforts and financial investment to remove the easements or ensure that they are transferable to new owners. If the deed language allows the owner of the easements, such as a utility company, to control that easement, it can pose a hardship on development. So it's really helpful to do some of this research up front so developers know what they're getting into. In addition to easements, some properties have unique permits connected with the property that can be transferable to future owners. For instance, this facility had a Delaware River withdrawal docket that allowed for 14.4 million gallons of water to be drawn from the river every day. And that's not an asset you find with just any property. Many industrial sites also have on-site rail spurs. As you see here, there are a number of rail spurs that come into the property, and there's actually room for 100 cars to be stored on the property at one time. Rail spurs can be viewed as either an asset or a constraint, depending on the developer's potential future use and the ownership of the spurs, and this is pretty important. If the rail spurs are owned by the property owner, which isn't always the case, then the property owner controls their use. But if the rail spurs are owned by the railroad, permission must be obtained from the railroad before they can be either removed or used for another purpose. It's also extremely helpful if there's rail on the property, if they have been inspected recently by the railroad and the inspection reports are made available to interested buyers. Fortunately, in this case, the rail spurs were owned by the property owner, and in addition to what you see on the property, just off the site down a little ways was a major rail yard, which is very attractive to industrial users. So many older industrial properties have multiple buildings on site. Now, whether they're usable or obsolete depends on their size, their condition, and where they're located actually within the property. And evaluating their condition and the presence or absence of hazardous building materials such as asbestos, PCBs, or lead paint is an out-of-pocket expense for developers. So anytime that information has already been compiled in a manner that can be easily digested by an interested party, it's very helpful. In this case, the property had over 30 buildings. All of these in light blue here you see are individual buildings of varying size, age, and conditions. And some of the buildings have been surveyed for asbestos and other materials. And these surveys, along with maintenance and repair reports, were made available to interested parties. And what was really helpful here is that some of those reports included things like replacement of roofs and how recent that was done, and condition of plumbing and other systems. In addition to the buildings, the property had numerous industrial assets. There was a central boiler house. It was actually only 3 years old. That served the entire property. There was a wastewater treatment system and a rail and truck loading facility. So these assets may present an opportunity for future end users. Maybe there's an interested party out there that is interested in rail to truck loading, and you've already got the rail lines here. Maybe somebody has a use for a wastewater treatment system for their own operations. But what we found really interesting in this project is that there's also an opportunity for companies who make part or all of their profit through demolition and scrap metal become interested in large former industrial sites in order to get in there and do that as the first stage of the development process and use that income from that portion of the work to help finance the beginning stages of redevelopment. So I know oftentimes communities are trying to find money to demolish buildings or to clear the sites and whatnot, but don't overlook that there may be an opportunity to actually bring other interested parties to the property, because you do have these assets that may be obsolete or of no interest to the market. So one of the questions that was raised was regarding ecological characteristics, and as I said, ecological and environmental characteristics can constrain development. Development in floodplain and wetland areas are not only regulated, but in many cases, developers cannot obtain financing or insurance for developments in these areas. Even projects seemingly low development, such as a solar array, are often uninsurable in floodplains. In addition to the common regulatory constraints, such as wetlands and floodplains, some states have further regulations along coastal regions, in high-quality habitat zones, and old-growth forests. This property only had limited floodplain and wetland issues, and these are the areas you can see down here. Pink was wetlands, blue floodplain. These had other restrictions that we'll get into in a minute. But the property was also regulated under Delaware's coastal zone, which added complexities not only to what you can and can't do on the site, but also the entitlement process that developers had to go through in order to get approval to do a development on the site. So we're obviously talking about brownfields and other contaminated properties here. And in this case, the environmental status was not considered a significant constraint on reuse. The reason being that this is a well-characterized site, and interested parties could quantify the risks and costs associated with cleanup and redevelopment and ownership. It was particularly helpful that all the environmental documents were readily available, allowing interested parties to review the environmental status without investing significant resources gathering facts and data. The information was ready and waiting for them when they came to the property. And to the extent that you can do that and make that available for the properties in your community, the easier it is for developers to evaluate risk and ascertain their level of interest in the property. This property had four regulated closed areas that had deed restrictions. In this particular case, the deed restrictions said that no structure of any kind could be developed on these areas. Now, that's not always the case, as oftentimes deed-restricted areas can be used for parking or other development components. In this particular case, they could not be, but fortunately, these areas were relatively small as compared to the overall property. Following the opportunities and constraints analysis, a market analysis was performed. And with the information from these two evaluations, the property owner was able to clearly articulate to the real estate market the competitive advantages of this property. And they were the large size of the site. There were not many properties of similar size available in the market. There were minimal wetlands and floodplain areas, and that meant that a majority of the site could be redeveloped. The excellent multimodal access, rail, highway, waterway. As you can see in this image right here, there's a shipping channel very close to the property, and so access was superb there. The utilities and infrastructure were attractive features because while some of it was older in age and needed some upgrades, there was significant infrastructure at the property, and all of it had been recently in use. And finally, that water draw permit that we talked about a minute ago was of special interest, and we wanted to take a look and see what types of entities might be interested in these assets. So we put together an industrial asset matrix, and what this does is it looks at the assets on the property and compares that to the assets that might be interested by particular land uses. So as you can see here, industrial uses would definitely be interested in what this property had to offer. Power generation needed many of the assets that were here. And some government uses also had potential there. And as you see as this plays out, how this actually, the market responded to these assets. So having identified the appropriate target markets, we then created a series of graphics to communicate the opportunity available, such as this one you see here, which shows the available area for redevelopment. This is an important graphic because when a developer looks at a property, especially a property with land use restrictions, floodplains, wetlands, their valuation of the property is going to be limited to the areas that they can redevelop. So a 100-acre site can easily become an 86-acre site or even smaller if you have a lot of regulated areas on your property that would constrain development. And that's what development community is interested in, and that's what they're willing to pay for. So we took a number of important steps to reposition the site and make it known to the market. And you'll see here one of the things that we did was created a logo for the site. And you don't need to always do this on a property, but sometimes when a property has a stigma or a historic name applied to it, you need to give it a little bit of a different name in the marketplace to overcome any of the historical references to the property. We did drone photography, which was extremely helpful due to the size and expanse of the property. You saw a number of the photos in the earlier slides. All of that was done with drone. And the photography not only communicated the site characteristics, it was critically helpful to communicating the relationship between the site, the Delaware River, and the greater Wilmington, Philadelphia region. We created a website specifically about the property as a resource for information and documents on the site. We engaged with the local community and informed them of our work to set realistic expectations. And we worked directly with the county and state economic development agencies. The property was added to the state list of available industrial sites, And in this case, the governor of Delaware recorded a video welcoming interested developers to the state and committing to a streamlined entitlement process. And that video was the homepage of the website, as you see here. This was critically important given the size of the property and its economic potential, because as we talked earlier, a majority of development is local and a majority of developments are smaller than this. This is a significant size property, and it had a significant economic impact on the region. So we administered an expression of interest process, and what is that? We've talked about it a little bit in the previous webinar, but this was a process used to further evaluate the redevelopment potential of the property. We knew what the assets were, we knew what the constraints were, we knew what the target markets were, but we also needed to go out to the market and find out, you know, were we missing anything and was there any real interest here? An expression of interest process is a formal process that creates a competitive atmosphere, so it encourages interested developers and end users to formally express their interest and begin discussions with the property owner. It's an effective way to evaluate reuse potential while at the same time building momentum for redevelopment. And through this process, we obtained three different but very serious redevelopment options. The first was a distribution and logistics center. The second was a data center with a component of power generation. And the third was an expansion of the local port. It's interesting when we looked at the interest that was expressed to see which site characteristics each party found attractive. All three developers liked the site access, the highway and the rail. Two of them found the waterfront beneficial, but one of them, actually the data center, was very concerned about the waterfront as they had to be cautious with the concern of climate change and limit the size of the building because of the relationship to the river. Party B is defined here, looked at the demolition as a revenue source, and I mentioned this early. They considered it as part of their financial model to come in and do the demolition and get the redevelopment process going. However, two of the parties also had time-sensitive developments. Both distribution and data centers are built to spec, and they have to meet a specific need of an end user. These developers were looking for a streamlined process. They appreciated the commitment on the part of the state, but they still had concerns because both of those uses had some very specific permits that were necessary, and so they were concerned about that. To put this in perspective, a typical Amazon warehouse distribution development must be completed within 18 to 24 months, and that is from the time of site selection, site acquisition, all entitlements, construction, and opening. That's a pretty fast timeline that you have to meet, especially if you have to go through an extensive entitlement process. So what was happening is, as I mentioned, there was a lot of outreach and engagement with the local economic development authorities. While this expression of interest was going on, the Port of Wilmington was conducting its own site selection process for expansion of the port. Now, we talked about how you don't always know what's going on. At the start of this, we didn't know the Port of Wilmington was looking for the expansion of the port. Through all of the outreach and engagement of this process is when both parties realized what the other party had to offer. The outreach to the county and the state brought this property to the attention of the port, and ultimately, this property became the port's preferred location. As you can see here on this graphic, there were three locations they were seriously considering, and this property became its number one location. So ultimately, the Diamond State Port Corporation purchased the site It now owns the site and has plans to invest $400 million to build a new container terminal with high-paying jobs to build off of the port that is located just slightly downriver. So hopefully that gave you a little bit of a sense as to how all of these things work together to make a development happen, how the information and data collected feeds into a redevelopment plan, and how you can help promote and move your redevelopment process forward by encouraging the data gathering portion of this process. Amy, I'm going to turn it over to you now because I'm sure there's a few more questions.
We have some questions, and actually, Elaine, I'm going to ask the questions pertaining to the case study, and then we'll just, since that's fresh, and then we'll go back and ask the other questions. The first question I have is, so you're talking about a few slides back about the steps that were taken to reposition the site with the drone photography and engaging local and state leaders. So I'm not sure if you mentioned this, but this property already like controlled by the city, or who owned this property, and basically who paid for those steps to reposition the site?
Sure. So this was still owned by the private corporation.
Okay.
It was a very, because it was such a large site and a fairly significant employer that was shutting down operations, mm-hmm. it was a priority for the region to get this back into reuse as quickly as possible. And so there was certainly a commitment made on the part of the company to invest in some of this work that needed to be done up front to pull this all together.
Right.
But some of these things can be done by a community without, you know, a significant amount of investment. Even, you know, drone photography is becoming less and less expensive every time, and that may not even be appropriate for a lot of sites, but certainly photography, even decent cell phones can do good photography to make sure that people can visualize what's out on the property.
Cool. Great. Thank you. Also, pertaining to the case study, you had the slide. Maybe I'll just go back. I think I can probably go back to this slide right here, where, you know, you said this was like really helpful so that people could get an easy sense of what's available for redevelopment. Two questions here. One, can you, and if I missed it, can you explain what's that carve-out area at the top of the property there?
Like, sure. So you might remember. Sure, you might remember earlier slide I discussed that there were areas that had deed restrictions, and in this
mm-hmm.
case, the deed restrictions did not allow any type of development. If you go
okay.
forward one more.
Oh, one more.
So,
there.
There, that one right there. So
oh, okay,
those four areas had deed restrictions because they were closed, regulated areas. In this particular case, and as I said, it's not always this case, they couldn't be developed on at all, not even for parking. So while the property owner wanted to sell the entire property and to get an interested buyer to take responsibility going forward, there really wasn't a significant benefit to having these. So a property new owner was not going to pay for that acreage, if you will, and that's just what you need to understand, is that if they can't use it, they're not going to pay on a per acre basis for that particular land.
Got it. Awesome. Thank you for clarifying. And then one more question. I'm going to go back to this slide. With the environmental characteristics, and you mentioned here like flooding and wetlands and things like that. Can you just talk a little bit more about the challenges? You talked about not being able to get insurance for this site and then possibly not, you know, then getting financing. So can you just talk for 1 minute about kind of the relationship between insurance and financing? And
absolutely. So obviously financing and insurance is needed on all projects, but certain projects are more high risk than others, and especially when we talk about rising water levels and climate change and whatnot, it's become more and more of a challenge and a little bit of a gray area along coastal and big rivers like this in terms of changing risk levels. But essentially, in a situation like this, the property developer would not be able to get financing for the areas along the waterfront. So they couldn't put any significant development in that area unless it was a waterfront-dependent use. If you're talking a dock or a barge area or something like that, it's obviously that is waterfront and that's special insurance. But you couldn't put your major building right up against the water because they're not going to get it insured there. I've seen in some cases along rivers where communities have thought, well, this area floods a lot, but why don't we just put in solar instead of worrying about a building? You might be able to get that through some of your local regulatory approvals, but you will not get insurance on the solar array, nor will anyone finance technology of that significant of investment in an area that's prone to flooding. So you really have to look at what the boundaries are of your flood zones. You have to look at your boundaries of your wetlands. You have to look at your transitional zones. So it's not just the immediate zones. It's what's the transition 50 feet, 100 beyond that zone. And you may be limited to where you can, what you can develop in those areas, if at all.
Excellent. Thank you very much. One last question about the case study. You mentioned earlier that there is a pretty good buffer between the site and the residential area. Were there other concerns, or is there anything that you're aware of in regarding to like the community's reception to this project? Was there a community benefits agreement in place? Was there anything about like local hiring, living wage jobs, anything like that that you're familiar with?
So this was a former industrial site that was regulated under RCRA, so there was a community advisory panel in place, and so the corporation met with the community advisory panel and talked with them before even starting any of this. What you're not seeing in the aerial, on this particular aerial, but to the north along the river is a whole waterfront park. So what was interesting here is the community did not really want much more in the way of parkland. They wanted the jobs, and that was very clear in meeting with them up front. It was about jobs. And so that was something that, speaking with the developers, that the company made pretty clear. There was some interest by some users that would have been very limited in jobs, but larger technology-type developments that might have been good tax generator, but didn't only needed a handful of jobs, and this was a significant employer. So they did listen in terms of what the community was looking for, and ultimately that's why the port, one of the reasons the port rose so high in consideration was the fact that they were good paying and a number of jobs required.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for all that extra detail. Mm-hmm. Abby, I wanted to go back to you with a couple of questions. So one of the things that you talked about was regional cooperation, and it's really interesting about how, you know, you're not really competing with, like, within your region until you're in the final stage. And so I was wondering if you can think of any good examples of regions that have been able to showcase their properties, as you said, across jurisdictional lines. And if so, like, who manages that? Who's the, like, entity that kind of takes that on for the region?
Sure. Sorry if I interrupted somebody else. But Yeah, you know, the one that I can think of that came first to my mind was it's New Haven, the area surrounding New Haven, Connecticut. They actually did a, as you might imagine, Connecticut has a ton of small towns and not really a strong county. So the regions, you know, they're working, they have to sort of create their own thing to work together. And New Haven was the largest town in sort of the surrounding region, and they did a really great job of coming together when either a site came up that was available, a large site to come together and sort of start to market that site cooperatively. But also if somebody expressed interest in a particular area or a particular town, they would tend to gather the other towns around to promote the region as a whole. And in my experience there, it was done by the Regional Economic Development Organization. They had a really big role in that and facilitating it and bringing all of the partners together. Elaine, I don't know if you have another example you want to talk about as well.
Actually, I was going to go back to the slide that Abby actually talked to that about,
okay.
Because that was an area in East Chicago and Gary, Indiana, and that particular development, you know, there was an actual property, several properties, but one particular property where there's a proposed distribution warehouse, but it was the airport in Gary, Indiana, over here that actually drove development over here in East Chicago, because there wasn't enough room over in the airport to actually put a distribution facility of that size, and yet there was this Brownfields property over in East Chicago here that had the size and was close enough. So what happened there is it was the region together, the communities working together to get that promoted, and it was the airport as an airport authority also, so it's not just the city, but it's an airport authority that's looking at the broader region and not just singularly at a particular city.
Great. Those are really two great examples. Thank you. Okay, then the last question I see is, I'm just going to move to this slide. It's about this slide, and it is talking about community input. And basically, if you could just give us a little more thoughts on or an example of how much vision or planning by the community is too much, such that a developer might feel constrained. A little bit of background on that. You know, we really encourage and want to encourage communities to do the planning and the visioning and have those goals, do it in this market-based reality, as you talked about. But just how much is too much, where that developer might just feel like, the expectations are too high, or I have no flexibility.
And Abby, I'll jump in here if you'd like.
Yeah, sure.
I think when you come to the community planning, it's a very important tool. There's two things that developers dislike. One is when everybody is in a not-in-my-backyard scenario, so they rather know what the community is willing to accept or not accept, so that's important. At the same time, to overly prescribe how a property should be redeveloped makes it very difficult for a developer. It's one thing if the community looks at it and says, we've got all our facts together and we really need some retail and we want to attract retail developers and here's all our information. The types of retail that we think is needed in this community might be these 6, 7, 8 types of uses. That's one thing, but to tell a developer that I need a Walmart and only a Walmart and be that specific is where we get really, that's where developers walk away, because they can't come in and come up with a different idea They may come in and say, look, based upon the size of your population, the size of your traffic counts and all of this, we can bring in a dollar store, or we can bring in an Aldi, which is a different type of grocery store, but we can't bring in the top tier. This is what the market is. That's one thing if the community is open-minded about that. But when they're overly prescriptive is when it tends to turn developers away.
Can I just say something really quickly there, if that's okay? I think there is a difference between, as Elaine was saying, informed and uninformed. If the community has the facts, I think that makes a really big difference. But in a lot of our projects that we work on, I do feel that it stays much more at a conceptual level than it does very here's where this retail storefront would go, and here's where this warehouse would go. It's more, you can invite people in to say that we can do a 20,000 square foot building on this site. So there's it doesn't have to be use specific from the beginning. You could still have a process without drilling down to uses.
Great.
Yes.
Thanks for that extra point. I really have one more question. I almost missed this one, and then we'll be done. So the last question is kind of getting back to our earlier discussion about underinvested communities or distressed communities. Have you seen any really successful methods for these types of communities to get their data together, and what's most effective to get their data out to developers?
So I would say that I think that the points that I made about having websites, having information all available online, I think having that information collected and ready to go is very important. And really marketing your sites in every possible way. So if there are the regional databases that you can put available properties in, do that. If it's those infrastructure investments, get those into newspapers or collect that information on your website. Talk about investments the community has made. As Elaine mentioned before, 80% of the research is done before you're even aware as a community that it's happening. So having it easily accessible so a developer can be sitting there at their computer or on their iPhone and pull up information, that's ideal. They don't have to pick up the phone necessarily.
And Amy, I'll just add that I agree with Abby that having it online in some form or another is really critically important. And it's also a really great project for an intern to do. It doesn't have to be, resources that you have on a regular basis. You can be updating this, once a quarter, twice a year if you really don't have that much going on, and it's a great job for an intern.
Great tip. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to speed through these slides and close this out. So give me one second here. Okay, great questions, everybody. Thank you, first of all, to our presenters. You guys did an excellent job, and really grateful for the expertise and examples that you shared with us today, helping us all understand all the different pieces that factor in and specifically what communities can do about it. I think that's a really exciting part of this whole series that we're doing. So we are at the end of our second webinar, so that means we've got one more in a couple of weeks. We are going to be talking about how developers make money on November 8th and also describing some of the financial tools that they need to bring into development. So please join us for that. Also going to remind you about our upcoming Brownfields Training Conference going on in LA. Again, we are doing the workshop there that helps pull all of these concepts together and gives you a really good insight into this whole process. So I really hope that those of you who are coming to the conference please make your plans around that and join us, because it's going to be excellent. And with that, thanks again, everyone, for joining. We had an incredible turnout today, and I'm going to turn it back over to Jean. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so very much, Amy. Let me walk through just a few quick closing items before we officially shut down today's live event. For those of you who are interested in learning more about sessions like this, you've obviously been on Amy's distribution list, but you can also check us out at the Cleanup Information Network with cluin.org. But I will answer the one question I saw a lot coming in. If you're looking for copies of the presentations and resources that were discussed during today's webinar, we've already posted those on the seminar slides or resources link. So you'll see that on the middle right of your screen under a window called Related URLs. You can scroll through that list, look for something that says Seminar Resources, click it to select it, and then press the Browse To button. That'll actually open up that website where you can access the materials. Those are all also active hyperlinks. So there were other documents that were mentioned and other websites that were highlighted. So I encourage you to browse through those links and be sure to check them out after today's live broadcast. And for those of you who are watching the recorded version of today's webinar, those links are still active in the archive. You can follow the links right on over and still access the materials through that window. For those of you who are looking for credits or participation certificates or want to share your thoughts on our session, I'd ask you each to fill out our online feedback form. We do issue certificates for attending the webinars or replaying the archives, but the only way to get one is to fill out our feedback form. So again, I'll draw your attention over to the Related URLs window. Look for the link that says Seminar Feedback. Click it and press the Browse To button. That'll open up an online feedback form where you can share your thoughts on today's session, both the content and the way that we delivered it. Be sure, though, when you're filling out that form to certify you were here for the whole thing. If there's a box at the very bottom of the form, and if you don't check that box to certify you were there, there won't be a certificate generated. So I would, again, encourage you to fill that form out. Make sure your email address is correct when you fill it out. And as soon as you submit your feedback in, as long as you check that box, you'll immediately have access to a certificate that you can either print out or save for your own records. If you participated in a large group in a conference room, all you'll need to do is get that link to the feedback form from the person who registered, and then each person can fill out the feedback form even if they didn't sign up individually. So those of you in groups, you can still get your own certificates to document your participation. Usually our attendees, along with that certificate, and either a copy of the materials or a printout of the seminar description page, are able to verify their participation with enough information to get credit with their own accrediting institution. And as noted earlier today, our session was recorded, and that email will go out to you in about 1 week. So as soon as that archive is available for on-demand replay, you'll get a link in your email with instructions on how you can access it. So with that, I want to echo everyone's thanks for those of you who joined us live, as well as those of you who've been replaying the recording and made it this far. This will go ahead and be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast. Thanks so very much for joining us.